I'm Montse Alvarado. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, challenge to his critics. A defiant Joe Biden delivers a message to congressional Democrats regarding the 2024 presidential election. We have team coverage. A country in chaos. Analysis of the situation in France after the snap election called for by President Emmanuel Macron. Sweeping into Texas. New developments in Hurricane Beryl as it makes landfall in the Lone Star State. And Lord of the Rings. A landmark achievement for a school in Spain dedicated to a lost art. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. I'm Montse Alvarado in for Tracy Sable. Our top story tonight. President Joe Biden defends his decision to stay in the presidential race. He sent a two-page letter to fellow Democrats outlining his reasons after having extensive conversations with party leaders. We have comprehensive team coverage. Eric Rosales will bring us reaction from lawmakers on Capitol Hill in a moment. But first, we turn to correspondent Tara Mergener at the White House. Tara.
Monse, President Biden wants to remove any doubt about his plans for re-election, telling Democrats it is time to come together, move forward as a unified party, and defeat Donald Trump.
President Joe Biden starts the week with an appeal to his supporters. He begins by proclaiming, "I am firmly committed to staying in this race." The president did not plan any public events, but he did release a detailed two-page letter for the public to read. He writes, "I wouldn't be running again if I did not absolutely believe I was the best person to beat Donald Trump in 2024. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre also defends the president after his poor debate performance last month fueled concern about his mental and physical health.
So the president's going to continue to go out there. He's going to continue to be present in the communities. He's going to continue to hear directly from the American people. And that's the best way to do this."
President Biden adds, "The voters of the Democratic Party have voted. They have chosen me to be the nominee of the party." His wife and family also encourage him to stay in the race. First Lady Jill Biden returned to the campaign trail today in Wilmington, North Carolina.
"For all the talk out there about this race, Joe has made it clear that he's all in."
President Biden also brought up the issue of abortion in his appeal to Democrats, writing, "I have made it clear that if Kamala and I are reelected and the nation elects a Democratic House and Senate, we will make Roe v. Wade the law of the land again." But Bishop Donald Hine of Madison recently told us,
"Mr. President, you should not be afraid of going against the grain and standing up for life."
Now, during an off-camera interview, Biden insisted average Democrats want him to stay in the race and says he's frustrated party officials are trying to get him to step aside. And he says, "They're big names, but I don't care what big names think." At the White House, I'm Tara Mergener, EWTN News Nightly.
Thanks so much, Tara. On Capitol Hill, Democrats are growing increasingly wary of sticking with President Joe Biden following his disastrous performance in Atlanta. The overwhelming response since the underwhelming response since then from Biden, his campaign operation, and the White House has angered scores of rank-and-file Democrats. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us with the latest. Eric, what are you hearing?
Well, good evening, Monse. Yes, the president's fate is all-consuming up here on Capitol Hill as members return from their July 4th recess. Now, congressional Democrats won't have party meetings until tomorrow morning, but many are already saying that President Biden's two-page letter, as Tara highlighted, isn't enough for them to change their minds. And some are still calling on Biden to get out of the race. Congressman Seth Moulton of Massachusetts adds that the Democratic Party needs a new strategy.
That's what the Democratic Party and President Biden in particular needs to do right now. Let's face the facts, be willing to make a change, and ensure that we can defeat Donald Trump in November.
And the list is growing, nearly a dozen. Over the weekend, four more Democrats who hold top positions on key committees want Biden to drop out of the race. They include Adam Smith of Washington, Jerry Nadler of New York, Mark Catano of California, and Joe Morelli of New York. And Congresswoman Angie Craig of Minnesota posted a statement on X saying in part, quote, "This is not a decision I have come to lightly, but there is simply too much at stake to risk a second Donald Trump presidency. That is why respectfully I call on President Biden to step aside as the Democratic nominee for a second term as president and allow for a new generation of leaders to step forward." As Biden spent the weekend campaigning, he is bleeding support not just among Democrats, but also donors. However, majority of Democrats still support the president for now.
I'm not so concerned that I have concluded that I will not support President Biden. I'm supporting him, and I do believe he is the best person for the job. I'm not just saying I support him, and if there's another person out there, let's look for that person. I'm not in that camp.
I believe Joe Biden is actually the right Democrat right now. And also, I'd like to point out that Sleepy Joe put Trump to bed in 2020, and I believe he can do this in 24.
The mudslinging continues. Meanwhile, Democrats know that they are up against the clock should they choose to act, with the Democratic National Convention taking place in August in Chicago, when they are set to formally nominate Biden as president. Monse?
Thanks so much, Eric. Well, Hurricane Beryl slammed into the Texas coast today. It made landfall at 4 a.m. local time as a Category 1 hurricane with sustained winds at 90 miles per hour. The storm has claimed two lives in Texas, and another 2.7 million homes are without power. Beryl was downgraded to a tropical storm as it moved inland, but serious flooding, storm surge, and tornadoes remain a threat. Here to discuss the impact of the storm on local residents is Cynthia Colbert, the president and CEO of Catholic Charities of Galveston, Houston, the hardest hit region by Beryl. Cynthia, thank you for joining yourself and for making yourself available on this very difficult day. First and foremost, how are you holding up during this storm and what are you experiencing?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity. My home, we were fine. We were north of Houston, had a lot of wind and rain. In fact, a tree cracked off and fell onto my neighbor's home and went through the roof. And so he's got a lot of damage. He's okay, but his home isn't. We were fortunate. We didn't have that experience. But now, even before the storm and now, I'm really focused on, okay, what do we do? And let's get to work to help Houston recover.
Well, as you look across the diocese, what are those immediate needs for those impacted by the storm, and how are you going to provide for them?
Sure. After a storm, Catholic Charities is what we call one of the early responders. We're not first responders, but we are an early responder before we move into recovery. So we'll be providing things to help people meet their basic needs. For example, if they've had rain damage in their home or anything else, they might not be able to go to work. Maybe they've lost their car. They've lost all the food in their refrigerator because they don't have power. So we provide some limited financial assistance. We provide cleaning supplies for people to pick up. We provide food. We're a partner of the Houston Food Bank and distribute food. And so we try to meet the basic needs that people have after the initial storm has passed.
From Hurricane Ike to Hurricane Harvey, you all have a lot of experience with hurricanes and with partnering with the government. The greater Gulf area truly has faced a constant barrage of storms over the past 15 years. How big of a hardship has that been on the people of Houston and on the work that you do?
Well, I personally have helped this agency and our community for the past 12 years. And I say it's not if, it's when. So if it's not a hurricane, it very well could be a tropical storm that looms over us and causes flooding. The most recent derecho caused a lot of wind damage. So I will tell you what I know about Houston and our region and our Catholic Church. We are a resilient group. We know how to get together to help the community recover. What you'll see is Knights of Columbus, well, the St. Vincent de Paul, other Catholic parishes with ministries will all kind of pitch in and do what we can to help the community recover. The longer term is those who have very low resources, maybe were uninsured or underinsured, and if they have damage to their home, they're going to need repairs. So we'll be calling on the community to help with repairs. longer term. And we provide case management that help people get back on their feet to pretty much how life was before the storm. But what I know about Houston, we are resilient, we're collaborative, we lean on our faith. We know that God has a plan and he has us in the palm of his hands. And so with faith and grit and hard work, we're going to get back to where we were pre-hurricane.
Absolutely. God has you in the palm of his hand. Cynthia, before I let you go, if people want to help and join in those relief efforts, what should they do?
Well, if you could go to our website, it's catholiccharities.org. We'll have a link for volunteers to sign up. And we'll need volunteers to help distribute food, answer phones, a number of other things. We're in multiple locations in three different counties, and we have damage across all of those areas. So volunteers will be a big part of how we help the community recover. And then if you want to donate, you know, it's going to take more than the resources I currently have. And so we're going to pull all these resources together, apply for some grants, but the generosity of the church and the broader community is important. So you can also donate to help in these relief efforts.
We'll be praying for those efforts. Cynthia Colbert, Catholic Charities of Galveston, Houston, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ukrainian officials say at least 31 people are dead after dozens of Russian missiles hit multiple cities across the country. It's the heaviest bombing in 4 months. Officials say one strike partially destroyed a large children's hospital in Kyiv. Emergency crews searched the rubble for survivors. More than 40 missiles struck the country, though many were shot down before they could do damage. Russia says it targeted military air bases and defense plants and denies aiming at civilian facilities. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly, including what a difference a week makes. The results of France's election defied expectations after the first round of voting. Why a turn to the left is leaving the European nation in uncharted territory. And we'll explain why protests in Kenya are about more than just a controversial finance bill. Today, the French are adjusting to a new reality, a fractured government. In a result that the polls did not predict, a coalition on the left unexpectedly won the most parliamentary seats in the final round of France's elections. Supporters took to the streets to celebrate. Despite the celebrations, there's no majority in place. President Macron's centrist alliance is behind the left-wing coalition. Right-wing candidates are in third after drastically increasing their seats in parliament. The results are the opposite of the moment of clarification that led President Emmanuel Macron to call the snap election last month. For analysis, we turn to Rosa Balfour, director of Carnegie Europe. Rosa, it's great to be with you. As we mentioned, last month, President Emmanuel Macron called for these snap elections, and it was widely viewed as a risky move. Did his decision backfire?
I wouldn't say it backfired. In fact, what we've seen is an impressive mobilization of French voters who turned out to vote to prevent the far right from gaining a majority. Which is what was expected after the European Parliament elections. And indeed, there was massive turnout in the high 60s. And what wasn't expected was that the left would actually do quite so well, and they came first.
French Prime Minister Gabriel Attal offered his resignation this morning, but has reportedly been asked to remain in his post for now. We're talking about stability. Why is this important?
Well, it's a caretaker government. Because no bloc has achieved a majority, the next steps are really quite awkward and unprecedented for French politics. The Olympic Games are about to start, and so there is a requirement for stability. Negotiations on the next government may take some time, so it's important to have a caretaker government in the meantime.
It's important to note that he wasn't in favor of the snap election either. Well, with no political faction even close to a majority to form a government, just like you mentioned, what happens next in France then? Many predictions say the European Union's second largest economy is headed for gridlock, which does not bode well.
Yes, it doesn't bode well at all. And as I alluded to earlier, France does not have a tradition of coalition governments. And the atmosphere before this vote was pretty sour. So it's a bit hard to imagine what kind of coalition might take shape.
Well, quickly, just one last question on security. There also was a protest last night in Paris that police were called in to disperse. Tell us more about this. What led to the protest, and could we see more of this in France? And in light of the Olympics coming up, how significant of an issue is this?
Yeah, no, indeed. Security is certainly an issue, and we've seen polarized politics taking place across Europe, across the United States, as you know, and things can easily get out of hand. So with the Olympics coming, there will be maximum alert so that the games can be carried out peacefully, and that there are no disruptions. But the French politics have often been passionate, shall we say. We've seen plenty of protests over the past few years, starting from the Gilets Jaunes in the early years of Macron's first presidency. All those sentiments are still there. I mean, that is one of the reasons for which so many French people voted for Marine Le Pen and for the far right. But it's also one of the reasons for which so many French people have mobilized against that type of politics. So we need to be very aware that the situation is tense and that there could be skirmishes in the streets.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, and we'll do that throughout the rest of the week. Thank you so much. Rosa Balfour, Director of Carnegie Europe, thank you for your time. Thousands of Kenyans gathered on Saba Saba, or 7-7 Day, this weekend to honor the nearly 70 people who have died since political protests began last month. The commemoration included masses at various churches around Nairobi, followed by a memorial concert. President William Ruto is facing mounting pressure as long simmering tensions continue to pour into the streets. Ruto was forced to scrap an unpopular tax bill as a result, and now the Gen Z-led protests are demanding even more change. The Catholic Church in Kenya is asking leaders not to ignore the protests. Here with analysis of the protest movement in Kenya is Ebenezer Obadare, a senior fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ebenezer, good to be with you today. Can you explain the evolution of the protests and political unrest in Kenya over the past few weeks?
Thank you. I can do that very quickly. So the protest started as a protest against what you call the finance bill, which was President Ruto proposing this bill that will increase taxes on ordinary Kenyans. But it's not just the idea of increasing taxes. It was the very items that were on that bill. Government was proposing to increase taxes on sanitary pads, on mobile phone services, on motor vehicles, on all those things that would touch the lives of average Kenyan. And people did not like that because of the mismatch that they saw between the burden that the ordinary Kenyan was being expected to carry and the life of privilege, opulence, and profligacy that President Ruto and members of his cabinet and the National Assembly in Kenya were perceiving to live.
Now, Ebenezer, it's been written that Kenya's protests mark a generational revolution in the country's politics. Do you agree with that statement?
I do. I think it's partly correct. So this has been called the Occupy Parliament protest, but it's also been rightly called the Gen Z protest. Gen Z meaning people born between 1997 and 2012. So 2002. So if you look at that, these are people who are just coming of age. Many of them voted for the first time for President Ruto in the elections that were held 2 years ago. Many of them are very savvy in their use of TikTok. Kenya, by the way, has the highest number of TikTok users relative to population in the world. So these are people who know their way around the social media, and they've made their voices felt in a way that members of the older generation, the previous generation, could not have imagined.
Well, keeping in mind that the original protest successfully stopped the tax bill, what's next for this movement? Will President Ruto be forced to step down, or could he pass meaningful legislation to appease these protesters?
I don't think we are at the stage of stepping down yet. I don't actually think many of the protesters want that. That seems to have been tacked on later in the protest. But what many of them wanted, I think they may have actually gotten, which was to have their fears, their anxieties, and their grievances conveyed directly to the Kenyan president. If you know that 2 days ago, the president actually had a meeting on Facebook with the protesters. 150,000 people showed up. A lot of harsh words were exchanged. President Ruto had to bow to the will of the people. He was calling them my brother, my sister, and they exacted very concrete concessions from him. So to that extent, you could say that the protesters have succeeded.
A significant digital revolution. Thank you so much, Ebenezer, Council on Foreign Relations. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, demand for change. Dublin Rally for Life draws large support calling for government action after 10,000 deaths. Plus, the Holy Father calls on the faithful not to keep their faith private when they enter the public square. The numbers are disturbing. Ireland recorded more than 10,000 abortions in the last year. That's according to the Irish Department of Health. Thousands marched through Dublin city center over the weekend. Rally for Life participants said they were demanding the government deal with what it calls spiraling abortion rates. They're asking lawmakers to look at life-saving measures like support for women, extending the 3-day wait period, and a heartbeat bill. Ireland's abortion laws were changed in 2019 after a referendum legalized the procedure. During his pastoral visit to the Italian city of Trieste, Pope Francis weighed in on the role of the faithful in political life. EWTN Vatican journalist Benjamin Crockett has more.
On the final day of the 50th Social Week of Italian Catholics, the Holy Father traveled to the northern Italian city of Trieste to share his thoughts on the crisis of democracy.
Come Cattolici.
The annual event is organized by the Catholic Church in Italy and is dedicated to promoting Catholic social doctrine. This year, the title of the event was At the Heart of Democracy. Addressing over 1,000 delegates from different dioceses and associations across Italy, Pope Francis focused on Christian engagement in politics and the need for courage to make proposals on behalf of justice and peace in the public debate.
Dobbiamo essere voce.
We need to be a voice that denounces and advocates in a society that is often silent and where too many have no voice. So many have no voice. This is political charity, which is not content with treating the effects, but seeks to address the causes.
After the concluding address, Pope Francis held a private meeting with a group of nearly 150 migrants and people with disabilities. Presiding over Holy Mass for approximately 8,500 people in the Unita d'Italia Square in Trieste, the Holy Father stressed that the world needs a faith that enters history, touches people's lives, and becomes a leaven of hope and a seed for a new world.
Brothers and sisters, above all, we need a faith that disrupts the calculations of human selfishness, that denounces evil, points out injustices, and challenges the schemes of those who exploit the weak from the shadows of power.
The port city is nestled between the Adriatic Sea and Slovenia. The location is a common arrival point for migrants coming to Europe through the Balkans. The Holy Father praised Trieste for being an open door to migrants and to all that struggle the most. Pope Francis insisted that God is found precisely in the dark corners of our lives and of our cities, and among the least, the forgotten, the discarded. In Rome, Benjamin Crockett, EWTN News Nightly.
Finally, tonight, a milestone as a school in Spain celebrates its first graduating class. And the subject matter just might ring a bell. The school teaches the lost art of church bell ringing. Teachers say they hope to prevent the ancient practice from dying out because many churches now use automated systems. The school seeks to recover the richness in the melodies that, for centuries, signaled a time for mourning or a time to rejoice. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. We leave you tonight with more from the church bells in Spain. I'm Montse Alvarado. Good night, and God bless.